Good morning again. I have a story to tell you, a favorite story of mine. Once, long ago, in the land of the short grass, there was a great hunger. No rain fell, and no grass grew. All of the animals were hungry. They searched in the jungle, they searched by the river, they searched on the great flat plain, but they could find nothing to eat. And so all of the animals, except for the lion, who was king, and lived in the jungle, walked across the flat, empty land looking for food. They walked and walked and walked, and after many days, they saw a small bump on the edge of the flat land. And they saw the small bump was a tree. And the tree was very tall. And the tree had fruit on it, such fruit as they had never seen before. It was as red as pomegranates, as yellow as bananas, as green as melons, as purple as plums, as orange as mangoes, and it smelled like all the fruits of the world. But the tree was so tall and the branches so high that even the giraffe couldn't reach the fruit. And the trunk was so smooth that even the monkey couldn't climb the trunk. So the animals sat on the ground and began to cry, because the fruit smelled so good, and they were so hungry. And at last, when they were too tired to cry any longer, a very old tortoise spoke. "Oh, animals," she said, "my great-great-great-grandmother told me a story about a wonderful tree. The fruit of that tree was delicious and good to eat, but it could be reached only by those who knew the name of the tree." Well, the animals cried out, "But who could tell us what the name of the tree is?" The very old tortoise answered, "The king knows. We must send someone to ask him." "I will go," said the gazelle. "I am the fastest runner of us all." And that was true. So the gazelle ran across the great flat plain. He ran like an arrow shot from a bow. And as he ran, he thought, "How lucky the other animals are that I am so willing to go, because I am the fastest runner of us all." Indeed, it was not long before the gazelle reached the jungle and the place by the river where the king lived. The king was sitting with his tail neatly wrapped around him. Every hair on his golden coat lay smooth and shining, and he spoke kindly to the gazelle. "What do you wish of me?" he said. "Oh, great king," said the gazelle, "all of the animals are hungry, and we found a tree filled with wonderful fruit, but we cannot eat the fruit because we don't know the name of the tree." He talked as fast as he ran. "I will tell you," said the lion, "but you must remember, for I don't want to tell anybody else. The name of the tree is Ungali." "Ungali," said the gazelle, "I will run as fast as the wind, and I will reach the tree before I can possibly forget." Well, the gazelle thanked the king and began to run through the jungle and across the great flat plain. He thought about how happy all the animals would be and how they would thank him and be grateful to him. He thought about this so hard he didn't see a rabbit hole that lay in his path, not far from where the animals were waiting. He stepped in it and went head over hoof over head over hoof. He landed in a heap at the foot of the tree. "What is the name of the tree?" shouted the animals. The gazelle shook his head. He shook it again, but the name was gone. "I can't remember," he whispered. The animals groaned. "We will have to send someone else, someone who will not forget." "I will go," said the elephant. "I never forget anything." The animals nodded, for this was true, and so the elephant strode off across the great flat plain. "I will not forget," she said to herself. "I can remember anything I choose to, even the names of all of my cousins." The elephant had hundreds of cousins. "Or the names of all of the stars in the sky." When the elephant arrived at the river, the king was sitting in his usual place, but the end of his tail was twitching, and his fur was ruffled. "What do you want?" he growled. "Oh, king," said the elephant, "all of the animals are hungry." "I know," said the lion. "And you want to know the name of the tree with the wonderful fruit. I will tell you, but don't you forget, because I absolutely will not tell anybody else. The name of the tree is Ungali." "I will not forget," said the elephant. "I never forget anything." And she turned and began to make her way out of the jungle. "Forget," she grumbled to herself. "Me forget? Why, I can remember the names of all of the trees in the jungle." And she began to name them. When she had finished with the jungle trees, she went on to all of the other trees in Africa. She was just starting on the trees of the rest of the world when she happened to step in the very same rabbit hole that had tripped the gazelle, and her foot fitted exactly in the hole, so exactly she couldn't get it out. The animals waiting under the tree saw the elephant and ran toward her, calling, "What is the name of the tree?" The elephant pulled and tugged and pulled and tugged, and at last, with a great pop, her foot came out of the hole. I can't remember, she said crossly. I don't care. That tree has caused far too much trouble already. The animals didn't even groan. They were too tired and too hungry. After a long time, a very young tortoise spoke. Oh, animals, he said, I will go and find out the name of the tree. You, said the animals, but you are so young and you are so small and you are so slow. Yes, said the very young tortoise, but I know how to remember. I learned from my great-great-great-grandmother, the one who told you about the tree. The animals had nothing to say, and the little tortoise was already on his way. It is true that he was slow, but by putting one short leg ahead of the other, he crossed the great flat plain, went through the jungle, and arrived at the place by the river where the king lived. The king was not sitting in his usual place. He was pacing up and down the bank of the river, waving his tail. His fur was standing on end. When he saw the very young tortoise, he roared, If you have come to ask me the name of the tree, go home. I have told the gazelle, and I have told the elephant that the name of the tree is Ungali, and I will not tell you. The very young tortoise nodded his head politely, turned, and began to walk out of the jungle. And as he walked, he sang, Ungali, Ungali, the name of the tree is Ungali, 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 the name of the tree is Ungali. And he went on singing it as he crossed the great flat plain. Ungali, Ungali, the name of the tree is Ungali. And he never stopped saying it, even when he got tired, even when he got thirsty, because that is what his great-great-great-grandmother had taught him to do. Even when he fell to the bottom of the very same rabbit hole, the very young tortoise just climbed out singing, Ungali, Ungali, the name of the tree is Ungali. None of the other animals saw him coming. They were sitting under the tree looking at the ground. The very young tortoise walked straight up to the foot of the tree and said in a loud voice, The name of the tree is Ungali. The animals looked. They saw the branches of the tree bend down so low they could reach the wonderful fruit that was as red as pomegranates, as yellow as bananas, as green as melons, as purple as plums, as orange as mangoes, and smelled like all the fruits of the world. The animals ate. They ate until they could eat no more, and when they lifted the very young tortoise onto their shoulders and marched around the tree chanting, Ungali, Ungali, the name of the tree is Ungali, because they did not want to forget. And they never did.
I get the pleasure of introducing Ian Riddell for his talk today. And it may be obvious already that he has served as the director of music ministry at James Reeb Unitarian Universalist. Some of you may have seen him there. In 2008, at General Assembly in Fort Lauderdale, he conducted the Singers of the Living Tradition, and that was the choir that was made up of ministers and religious leaders and their families at the General Assembly. He is now pursuing his studies in professional ministry at the Meadville Lombard School in Chicago. This summer, he will begin serving as ministerial intern at the Unitarian Universalist Church of the Monterey Peninsula, in beautiful Carmel, California. Ooh, but you know, you would have gotten an even bigger ooh if it had been about 2 months ago. Like now, it's okay. So please join me in welcoming Ian Riddell.
I do have to say, it's required of me to say that despite the gorgeous weather in Carmel, I'm very excited about the minister I'll be working with and the congregation, so I have to give them plug too. Thank you for having me here. It's nice to be back in Madison. Stories are important things. It matters what stories we tell each other and our children. Stories have a power that other ways of communication don't. Philip Pullman, author of The Golden Compass and its sequel, says, We don't need lists of rights and wrongs, tables of do's and don'ts. We need books, time, and silence. Thou shalt not is soon forgotten, but once upon a time lasts forever. Well-crafted stories have ways of creeping into our hearts and our minds and showing us new things and new ways to see old things. And so it matters what stories we tell. When we tell stories of fear and hatred of all that is not us, we build a world of fear and hatred. In this country, we seem to be increasingly unable to relate to each other as equals, as subjects with whom to be in relationship, rather than as objects upon whom to act. This inability is engendered, encouraged, and exacerbated by systems, organizations, individuals, commentators who inspire fear, paranoia, and hatred in us because they benefit from keeping us unstable and scared and demand that we actually not think about the world we live in. Think about the increasingly shrill and deeply disturbing debates on healthcare reform over the past few months. What stories have been told to the people calling out Nazi and baby killer and throwing bricks through windows and leaving death threats? What stories have they not been told? I think our task as religiously liberal people is not to shout these people down, though the temptation is there. Our task is to tell a different story, a story of love, of relationship, of understanding and collaborative power, rather than one of fear, paranoia, and alienation. To model a different way of living in relationship and community, and to engage in conversation and collaboration with all of those around us, whether they agree with us or not, to show that sharing this life on this world is necessary, rather than merely living side by side. And so what about the name of the tree, the story I told you? Well, when I was a child, I had an orange plastic record player. I loved my record player so much, and I was constantly plugging it in and listening to the Disney records I shared with my brother, and admittedly, my disco Star Wars record. But my favorite record was Danny Kaye Tells Stories from Around the World. He told stories like Master of All Masters and Nail Soup, but my favorite was The Name of the Tree, a version of the story that I told just a little while ago. Kay's version of the story had several differences, the biggest being that the tree has a different name. Uwongalema is the name of Kay's tree. And I've done a little bit of research, and that seems to be a more traditional name from the original African telling, but I went with Ungali. I listened to the story over and over again. And eventually I outgrew my little orange plastic record player and started using my dad's stereo. And at some point, my Danny Kaye record broke or disappeared, but the story stuck with me. Years later, when I was about to begin my first practicum as a student teacher on Salt Spring Island in British Columbia, I was searching through a children's bookstore for resources and came across Celia Barker Lautridge's version that I told you earlier. I took it with me into my kindergarten class that spring, and it has traveled with me ever since, into other classrooms, into bedtime stories with my niece, nephews, and goddaughter, into story time at Barnes & Noble when I ran the children's department. It did more than travel with me, though. Sorry. It became scripture to me. It became a story I could return to over and over again and constantly find new and deeper meaning and metaphor. Like any scripture, any good story, it said as much about my life as it did about its own characters. So what lessons can The Name of the Tree teach us? We could explore the power structures that give some knowledge and power that others have to ask for on bended knee. We could explore just what it is that fruit represents. We could explore what it means that the knowledge reaches the animals because the king makes a mistake. And what about that darn rabbit hole? And all of those things are important to the story and what it might mean to us. But what I'd like to focus on today is the three animals, the gazelle, the elephant, and the small, slow tortoise. And their different approaches to gaining the knowledge and power of the name of the tree and their differing success. The things that we seek in life for ourselves and our families and our communities can come to us for many reasons. Many of the things that we value in our society, wealth, power, influence, and fame, can come to us because of who we are, because we're born to them, because they're granted to us by our status. We can be the elephant, proud of who we are, secure in our status, and unaware and not paying attention. But the deeper things we seek in life and need cannot come to us through heredity or privilege. The gazelle has great talent and ability and knows it. Things come easily to him. Many of our successes in life can come to us through raw, basic talent, unasked for and unearned. I know what has happened to me in my own life when things in school came easily to me, and then I ran into something I couldn't do easily. I was lost. I had no skill to learn. How do I learn what I can't already easily do? When I was a freshman at the University of Toronto, I signed up for a Tai Chi class. I only lasted a couple of lessons because it was very hard and very different from anything I'd ever done before, and I had no frame of reference for how to do something new and difficult like that. Other things had come easily to me, and so I dropped out of Tai Chi class and didn't try again for years. But the tortoise, the poor, small, unassuming, slow tortoise who brings the animal the knowledge they need to access life, how does he do it? Not just hard work, the elephant and the gazelle work as well. The tortoise had discipline and practice. He had a plan. He has a habit he develops to allow him to gain what he needs most deeply, what his community needs most deeply. A little chant, over and over again. Ungali, Ungali, the name of the tree is Ungali. When I returned to the practice of Tai Chi 7 years ago, I was much humbler and acknowledged ahead of time that this would be hard for me and that I'd have to commit to practicing regularly, something I was not good at. Ask my piano teacher. I'd have to commit to practicing regularly if I was to gain any benefit from the Tai Chi form. In fact, that's specifically why I went back to Tai Chi. And while I haven't been perfect, my Tai Chi teacher will also attest to that. It's been much more deep learning I've done because I've committed to the process. I also understand, like anything important, I'm not going to have learned it for good one day. It's a lifelong commitment to a practice. In our attempt to access the benefits of a spiritually centered life, in our attempts at a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, in our desire to see each other and every person as worthy of dignity, which animal is more potent and powerful and useful as a guide? My money's on the tortoise. This past summer, I completed a 12-week chaplaincy internship at a Southside Chicago hospital. Aside from our duties in dealing with crises in the ER and around the hospital, we spent time every day visiting patients on our assigned wards. This meant we would see many different patients, one after the other, often in a very short time, and often dealing with powerful issues around death, illness, acceptance, hope, and grieving. It's a challenging thing to move from patient to patient and be present and respectful to each without completely draining yourself in the process. One of my Lutheran colleagues developed a small practice for herself. Before she visited with a patient, she would pause outside their room, say the patient's name several times, and invite God to enter the room before her. In this way, she entered each room with the patient in her heart and her mind and sacred presence as her goal. Saying a prayer or taking time for meditation in the morning were also important for many of us, but this small practice had a profound effect on how my colleague's ability to minister to her patients. When she didn't do it regularly, she felt less present with her patients. When it was a regular practice, her presence was calm and centered on the patient. I said earlier that this story that I told has become scripture to me. Many Christians and those of other faiths interact with scripture through the practice of Lectio Divina. In Lectio Divina, the practitioner encounters a passage of scripture in four ways: by reading it, meditating on its meaning, praying from what has been stirred in their heart, and finally resting with the text, just contemplating it. In a posting on this spiritual discipline, the Unitarian Universalist blogger, known as Chutney, talks about the kinds of texts that are appropriate for Lectio, what he calls wisdom literature. But what is wisdom literature, he says? It is literature that reads you. You may read it well enough, but if you're paying attention at all, it holds you in its gaze and it mirrors you back to yourself. And yet you'll find something fuller and larger than yourself in it, something that will linger after you've put it down. That something will challenge you, and if you devote time to it, he says, even a little, it will change you. Promise. You don't need to believe that any particular piece of wisdom literature is divine writ for spiritual reading to work for you. You just need something that will read you. And this is what the story of the tortoise and the tree has become for me. And my most recent return to the story reflected back to me what I described earlier about spiritual practice and more. What lingered for me was a connection between spiritual practice, the disturbing rhetoric around healthcare reform, and what all this means to this liberal faith we share and commit to. This liberal faith of ours that is not mine because I was born to it, even if I was. The elephant can forget and stumble if she doesn't pay attention. It's not mine because it fits with the way I see the world. Even if it does, the gazelle can be tripped up if he's distracted or thwarted. This liberal faith of mine and ours, I think, because I commit to it every day, because I struggle with it every day, because I practice it every day. Our tradition has no creed, but it is for me guided and shaped in many ways by the principles we affirm and promote, principles listed inside those hymnals beside you. In many ways, creeds are easy. For me, these principles are hard, complex, and challenging. They don't ask what I believe. They call me to test that belief daily, to live it out in community. They don't tell me what is holy. They call me to search for it constantly in humility. They don't ask me where I get my strength. They just demand that I use that strength always in service. This is not an easy task, friends. I've had conversations with those in other more conservative traditions who think we have it easy not having to be accountable to a creed and canon law. But it's hard work building a vital liberal faith. It's profoundly difficult day in and day out to find the name of our tree, to reach that fruit, to share its sustenance and joyful deliciousness with the rest of the world. And there are rabbit holes everywhere. It's daunting, and we are never perfect. But as Garrison Keillor so wisely said, we do the best we can. We do the very best we can, and tomorrow, God willing, we get to wake up and try again. Ungali, Ungali, the name of the tree is Ungali. Thank you. I think I'm not all that young, just so you know. I'm probably older than that person. But I think that like the elephant, and I'll say this about myself, I think that like the elephant, we get stuck in our ways. I think we know how the world has worked for us, and we see what we have been able to do in the world and how we've been able to make change and how it really works for us. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. But we're living in a very different world than we were living in when I developed those skills as a child to figure out what was going on. It's a really rapidly changing world. And I don't think we want to abandon what has held us together. But I think we need to not let ourselves be stuck in a place where we think that's the only way to do it. So I think to be open to new voices, I think, is a change. And I think we're not the only ones who have to do that. I think that the evangelical right wing, just to get up on my pulpit, well, I am at a pulpit, aren't I? I think one of the reasons, in talking about gay marriage, for example, I think one of the reasons that the right is so up in arms about gay marriage right now is they look at the demographic data and realize that younger people don't feel the way they do. And so they're just holding, they're trying to hold firm. And I think we need to be wary of doing the same thing, even those of us who are liberal, and ways of thinking and ways of being liberal, I think, and ways of being liberally religious. I think we don't want to abandon who we are, but I think we need to be open to other names of other trees, to push it back into that metaphor. I think it's very interesting that I do want to spend some time in my head. I mean, I think it's very interesting that the king just mistakenly gives up the information. And I think that those of us who are searching for information should be always aware that to grab every opportunity we have to get the knowledge that we have, even if even if the powers that be, however you want to see it that way, don't want to give it to us. I have to add that. Why doesn't the king eat? I think if he'd stuck around, he might have. But I hear what you're saying. I don't know that our principles are things we can hold fast to. I think they're slippery creatures. And I don't mean that in a bad way. Because I think, as I said, I don't think they tell us specifically what to do or what to believe. But they share with us, I think, where I gain inspiration from them, is in figuring out how to live with other people. I think one of the things that we can do while still remaining true to our principles that we commit to is learn how to see ourselves the way other people see us. To learn how, when someone comes in, whoever they are, comes in through that door, in any congregation, but let's just in through that door, and sees this congregation, or any congregation, when we live inside this congregation, this is the way we are, this is who we are, and it's not always comfortable, but it's normal, and it's just the way we are. And we quite often, I'll speak for my, we quite often don't see how other people might see that when they come in the door. And so it's not a question of changing who we are, but being aware of what other people are seeing, and having that inform how we are with them and with each other. I don't know if that's not very concrete, but to me it speaks to, we live in this world that we think is the way it should be, because we've lived in it for a while, it works for us, and we're smart people. We think we're smart people. And we don't necessarily always, I think learning to see us the way other people see us is an important piece. I hope that makes sense. Well, and I think we can't, if that's the way they're coming to the table, then us dumping on them doesn't do them any good either. I mean, one of the places this is really being seen, the gay rights issue, but also environmental movement, that a lot of what we would call more conservative but not right-wing, sort of more traditional evangelicals, are rereading their scripture and going and seeing, going back to Genesis and understanding, stewardship, and that this is the world we're living in, and that there are evangelicals who don't believe the world is ending tomorrow. And even if it is, it's God's earth and we need to take care of it. I mean, and so that may not be why we're environmentalists, if we are, but that's a huge step and a huge huge commonplace. And I think we need to live with each other, not just beside each other. So yeah, we as well need to be open to conversation and work together. Because I love this story and I'm never letting it go, just saying that. But I need to be careful and sensitive to whose story it is and how it's told. And most of the traditional tellings of this story have 12 or 13 different animals go. That doesn't work when you're sitting reading a story to our kinds of children who don't want to sit still. But just so you know, they all laugh when the king makes the mistake. But I think the tortoise being slow and quiet and unassuming is important. But I also think the connection to the great-great-great-great-grandmother. There's a real connection to the story to our ancestors. What did our ancestors, what skills did they have? What did my great-great-grandmother teach me? And not in the way that the elephant does, which is, look at all these wonderful people, but in the way that the tortoise does, which is to learn from them. So I think this quietness and the longevity of the turtle really, I think, is one of the places where that inspiration comes from the storytellers. I am in the middle of that in my own head, in my own heart. And I think that it's something that our movement is really struggling with right now, really deeply. I have, fellow students who are like, we need to figure out what our common beliefs are and go there. I have a professor who said, since merger, we've just come up with fabulous marketing campaign after fabulous marketing campaign with nothing to market. Or not nothing to market, but not having something solid to market. Personally, I'm still sort of torn. I mean, I think personally for me, and I'm just talking off the cuff here, so this is not holy writ. anyway, but I think for me, it's that what makes us is our way of being religious, not what the specific things are. Part of my heart, part of my head says, I don't worry too much about the lines between us and other people if we're doing the work in the world that the world needs. But that's not a line one wants. I mean, that doesn't help our movement grow or change. I think I don't have an answer because I'm mired in that sort of perplexing thing myself and figuring that out. I mean, there's obviously something that's holding us together because we are who we are and we've maintained. But I also think we need to be wary of. Not a battle of playing the game on other people's rules. In other words, that when those we see as our opponents get loud about being very rigid, I don't know if it helps us to leap to rigidity to combat that. Does that make sense? So that's just a thought that popped out of my head, but it's a tough, and you're not alone in struggling with that. And I think that our movement as a whole that's one of the things it's deeply struggling with right now. If you had an opportunity, the Commission on Appraisal, the UUA Commission on Appraisal, you can go to the UUA website. Their latest report is called Embracing Our Theological Diversity. And doesn't, again, come to any conclusions either. But it's a fascinating read about who we are theologically and organizationally. So I would highly recommend that. And I think that for me, thank you. I can't remember what that book is, but I did hear about it. I think that's true. I mean, I think that's a valid perspective on this, our reaction to the rest of the world or parts of the rest of the world saying it's about belief. And we are not that way. That's not how we are. That's not how we form church or congregation. That's not who we've become, I don't think. And so for me, it's more about who we are together and how we do, worship or how we do church or how we do congregation or how we do social action that is what makes us us. So I think I'll have to hunt that one down. I don't have a... I think there's a common feeling that we teach our children about all the other world faiths, and that's really important. And then don't ask them to stay in ours. We let them choose, and of course they should be able to choose. But that's again a struggle that we're struggling with, and I don't have an answer. I think it's wonderful. I think you would find a lot of Protestant denominations who would say the same things about themselves. So I think it's true. I think that's true, and I think it's core. If we're concerned about what makes us different from other people, that gets challenging. But I think that's a really simple, straightforward statement of the core of it.
Please thank Ian Riddell.
Thank you. I now have to go write 4 other sermons based on those questions. What Ursula Le Guin says about love, we can say about community. Love doesn't just sit there like a stone. It has to be made like bread, remade all the time, made new. Go in peace, my friends, to love and serve the world.